Iran International stops broadcasts from its London base, citing threats from Tehran, which labels it an enemy network. But an Iranian-American human rights lawyer says such threats will not deter Iranians in the diaspora.
The past few months are the first time, I think, that I've seen that fear go away, where people realize that there's a strength in numbers.
Plus, Israel's ambassador in Washington tells us that Iran, his nation's top enemy, is taking notice of Israel's latest military exercises with the U.S.
I believe the Iranians are watching very carefully, and I hope they draw the right conclusions. But this is not the only measure that is designed to enhance deterrence. There are others as well.
And later in the program, a former U.S. national security official urges the Biden administration to stop exempting Iranian nuclear projects from U.S. sanctions. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Persian-language TV news network Iran International closed its London studios Saturday and switched all broadcasting to Washington in response to what it called a significant escalation in Iranian state-backed terror threats against its staff. British police said they advised the network to move operations out of the London office due to grave safety concerns about its journalists facing hostile intentions from a foreign state. Iran International has long been critical of Iran's Islamist rulers and has heavily covered the protest movement that erupted there last September. Gisu Nia is a Washington-based human rights lawyer and director of the Atlantic Council's Strategic Litigation Project. I spoke to her by phone on Monday and asked what has made the network a significant voice in the Iranian diaspora.
Iran International is 24/7. They have coverage around the clock, and the fact that they put out so much content has meant that in the past few years, they've really gained a foothold in terms of an audience inside Iran. So people inside Iran can watch, you know, they have satellite television. That's how they watch Iran International. But I can't tell you how many people, the few times I've gone on the network, I immediately have messages from people inside Iran saying that they saw me. So it's definitely a channel that everybody is watching, or many, many people are watching. And I think that obviously is a bit of a threat to the regime, because what they are broadcasting is a lot of segments about human rights issues, really digging deep into the violations that the regime is committing. They platform a lot of human rights lawyers and defenders. And I know that people outside of Iran who might be a bit new to activism or who are intently following the events of the past few months, they're looking at Iran International as a major source of news. They sort of, you know, check the page to just get the latest on what's going on. So they've become a pretty, I think, sought out source.
Well, what impact do you think the closure of Iran International's London broadcasting headquarters will have on the efforts of Iranian diaspora leaders to, you know, unify and support the protests inside Iran for regime change?
I think what this sort of indicates is just how, I mean, the fact that the threats are this serious, that MI5 and the police sort of can't guarantee their safety, is just like an indication of how serious these threats are. And the fact that they have to, they literally have to shutter their office and go to DC is quite significant. The Islamic Republic has a long history of transnational repression. They conducted, you know, a global assassination campaign in the late 90s, early 2000s. And that's picked up some steam in recent years in terms of abductions, kidnappings, you know, threats on people's lives, like the dissident journalist Masih Ahmadinejad. But I think this is just an indication of how far they're willing to go. And to the point where law enforcement just says, like, there's no way that we can protect you. I mean, that's really stark. Normally, there's an attempt to ensure that people have security, that any targeted figures have some protections afforded them. But I think there was just a decision that having this physical location is just, you know, they're going to be unable to protect everybody affiliated with the network.
Have you heard any talk from people in the diaspora about how this could potentially chill their speech, their freedom of expression, their freedom to protest against the Iranian government?
I don't think so, because to be honest, I've been doing this work since 2009, basically since the violent crackdown from the Islamic Republic on peaceful protests that followed a disputed presidential election in June 2009. I've been involved in this work. And while there was an initial surge of support in the diaspora to look at, you know, developments in Iran and so on, in the years after that, I would often hear concerns from people about looking as if they're supporting calls to remove the Islamic Republic. They'd be concerned about using their real identity if they were working as a human rights researcher. You know, the chilling effect of a dictatorship can be quite significant and can cross borders. I mean, even once they're outside of the country, then they're still worried about their family and friends back home. And because this regime is one that does imprison family members for no reason other than association to somebody who's a perceived or actual dissident, it's a real and valid fear. But the past few months are the first time, I think, that I've seen that fear go away, where people realize that there's a strength in numbers, and that if everybody is saying that the regime needs to be overthrown, then there's a safety in that, because the Islamic Republic can't possibly go after everybody. And so I think some of that paranoia has dissipated, and some people have also made the calculation that it doesn't matter anymore, and that they're not going to plan on visiting Iran until there is a future-free Iran that they can visit. So I've seen a real shift, just personally speaking, in that mindset. And while the global community absolutely needs to crack down on any form of transnational repression because of the impact on dissidents and because of the chilling effect on freedom of expression, I do think that we're in a new period now. And so I personally think it will have limited impact on the zeal of people to continue calling for the regime to go.
Well, Gisu Nia, international human rights lawyer and director of the Atlantic Council's Strategic Litigation Project, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Great to have you on Flashpoint Iran this week.
Thank you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency says it is aware of U.S. media reports published Sunday asserting that IAEA inspectors in Iran detected uranium enriched to 84% purity in recent weeks. That figure is slightly below the 90% purity level at which experts say uranium becomes weapons grade. Iran said Monday it is not enriching above 60%, even if particles with a higher purity are present in the process, while the IAEA said it is talking to Tehran about the latest findings of its inspectors. In last week's show, I discussed Iran's nuclear activities with Israeli ambassador to the U.S. Michael Herzog, whose nation sees Iran as its number one enemy for seeking the destruction of the Jewish state. Tehran says its nuclear program is peaceful. Herzog told me Iran knows if it enriches uranium above 60%, there will be consequences and Israel will not be indifferent. In part two of our conversation, I asked him whether Israel's recent military exercises with the U.S. are enough to deter threats from Iran.
So yes, this was the biggest ever joint military exercise between Israel and the United States. I believe the Iranians are watching very carefully, and I hope they draw the right conclusions. But this is not the only measure that is designed to enhance deterrence. There are others as well. Ultimately, we in Israel strongly believe that if you want to impact the Iranian behavior, there ought to be not only pressures, but also a credible military option, kind of last resort option, as a backbone for military and political pressure. And that is what we're building and trying to do.
Does Israel have right now the military capabilities to potentially strike Iranian nuclear sites? And is Israel looking for any additional military assistance from the U.S. to do such a thing successfully?
Israel has always maintained a military option vis-a-vis the Iranian nuclear program, and we're building these capabilities constantly.
So, as you were saying, those joint U.S.-Israeli military exercises did send a message to Iran about the U.S. commitment to Israel's security. But in the past few weeks, we've also seen the U.S. become a bit more critical of how Israel is responding to a closer security threat, meaning terrorist attacks by Palestinian assailants. There have been multiple attacks in recent days and weeks. And the Israeli responses to these attacks have drawn some U.S. criticism. There was a joint statement by the United States and several of its Western European allies today strongly opposing Israel's plan to legalize some settlement outposts in the West Bank. We've also seen some U.S. criticism of Israel's plans for judicial reform. If you're Iran and you're looking at the U.S. becoming more critical of Israel, how do you think this criticism affects Iran's calculations about the strength of the U.S.-Israeli alliance?
So let me clarify certain things. First, the U.S. did not criticize Israel's counterterrorism operations. The U.S. understands quite well that when we are attacked by terrorists, and we are constantly attacked by terrorists, then we have to respond and we have to apply counter-terrorist measures. They know that. They do not criticize that. The discussion between the United States and Israel today is around political issues like settlement activities and others. And the whole political context between Israelis and Palestinians, the U.S. understands quite well that Israel has to take measures against terror because the PA has weakened, lost effective control over parts of the West Bank. There is proliferation of terror organizations, and to the extent that they do not act against them, we have to act against them, and there's friction. This is unavoidable, and the U.S. understands that. The debate is political. Having said that, it does not, and I want to emphasize, does not impact our close dialogue in Iran, our cooperation on Iran, and our relations. So I hope nobody draws the wrong conclusion. I think on Iran, we are close, we are united, and is not impacted by our discussions on the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
Going back to something we mentioned earlier, the drones that Iran is manufacturing, that Iran has provided to Russia, there's reporting that Iran actually wants to build a drone factory inside Russia. What is Israel's view of this cooperation when it comes to drones, and what is Israel doing about it?
So we follow very closely the developing cooperation between Russia and Iran. It looks like a kind of a military alliance that is being built between those two, and with some potential strategic implications. This cooperation is, of course, troubling to us because Iran is our number one enemy, the number one threat to Israel's national security, and naturally we are concerned about it. Part of our concern is what Russia might pay Iran in return for drones and some other military capabilities.
The U.S. has said Russia is likely to give Iran some kind of technology.
Russia will probably provide them with sophisticated combat planes and maybe some other capabilities. We are following very closely. We are taking measures, but I prefer not to elaborate. But we're definitely very much concerned about this kind of cooperation.
Now, Iran sent a letter to the UN Secretary General on February 1st accusing Israel of responsibility for a drone attack on a military factory in Isfahan in central Iran last month. And this letter warned that Tehran would respond resolutely to any threats and wrongful actions by the Israeli regime whenever and wherever deemed necessary. What is Israel's view of this threat by Iran, and what is Israel going to try to do to prevent any Iranian retaliation?
I'm not going to refer to specific publications or specific threats. I will say that I do believe that Israel has managed to establish a significant measure of deterrence vis-a-vis Iran. We've been taking action against their attempts to establish themselves militarily in our immediate vicinity in Syria. They've been trying to build Syria for years now as a formidable military front facing Israel, the same they did in Lebanon. And we took military action. We've been taking it for years now and managed to deter them without escalating. So I think they know exactly what will be the consequences.
Israeli Ambassador to the United States, Michael Herzog, thank you so much for speaking with Voice of America today.
Thank you very much. And I want to reiterate once again, we stand with the people of Iran.
Last week on this program, I spoke to International Crisis Group analyst Ali Vaiz about why he supports the Biden administration's recent decision to allow Iran to maintain several civilian nuclear projects with Russia by extending waivers from U.S. sanctions for those projects. This week, we get a different perspective from Richard Goldberg, a former White House National Security Council member in the previous Trump administration. Goldberg, a senior advisor for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, told me the U.S. should not extend sanctions waivers because the Iranian nuclear projects are part of a bigger problem.
Well, the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal in 2015, had one major fatal problem above all others, and that was it reversed course on the international expectation for Iran's clandestine, illicit nuclear program that had been uncovered by intelligence services years before and had been demanded by the international community to be halted, with facilities to be shut down, with enrichment to be completely removed from Iran, reprocessing capabilities completely removed from Iran. And instead of holding to that firm standard, the United States, along with its European partners and Russia and China, negotiated a deal that allowed Iran to retain all of that illicit nuclear infrastructure and to allow Iran to continue enriching uranium and to have potential future pathways to a nuclear bomb. But we didn't just allow them to retain it. We endorsed these capabilities through these nuclear waivers, through these international nuclear cooperation projects intended to legitimize an illegitimate program. So instead of saying, hey, you know, we found this clandestine facility of yours, Fordo, outside the city of Qom, and exposed it to the world in 2009, instead of saying there's no reason whatsoever to have an underground, under a mountain facility that's ready to use for massive, full-scale nuclear enrichment to build a nuclear weapon, you're not going to be allowed to keep that. We're going to destroy that. It's never going to be usable again in the future. Instead of saying that, we said, oh, you know what? No problem. You get to keep 1,000 centrifuges buried under the mountain in one area. And in another area, we just ask that you allow Russia to come in and do some radioisotope medical research with you and start using your centrifuges for positive ways.
But once Iran has already built that infrastructure underground, I guess the other argument is, you know, the site is there. Isn't it better just to make sure it's used for civilian purposes than trying to get Iran to completely remove something which they've just built into a mountain?
Only if you can trust this regime, because otherwise you're just, you know, playing the North Korea movie all over again. If we haven't learned our lesson, then shame on us. We clearly didn't. The same people, by the way, who negotiated the agreed framework with North Korea and got tricked over and over again by the North Koreans are the same people who negotiated the Iran nuclear deal. So how are we surprised that when Iran feels that it's threatened, wants to blackmail, extort the international community, no problem, kick out the Russians, restart these centrifuges, bring more out. And by the way, throughout the deal, we were allowing Iran, this has nothing to do with the nuclear waivers, we were allowing Iran to continue its research and development on advanced centrifuges so they could take those out of manufacturing, plug those into this underground facility, and now threaten us even more with enrichment. That's what we see happening today. And issuing a waiver there is virtue signaling of an appeasement policy where we are going to pay Iran, we're going to legitimize a nuclear weapons program, pretend like they don't still want to make nuclear weapons, and allow them to keep a capability to threaten us at any time they're choosing.
Well, I discussed this issue actually with the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Herzog, in a recent interview, and he told me that the deal is off the table for now. He used those words, for now. He didn't say the deal is dead, but he seemed pleased that the United States and its European allies are not moving in the direction of renewing the JCPOA at the moment. And he also said, in terms of the sanctions waivers for the Iranian civilian nuclear projects, it's understandable from Israel's point of view that those waivers are being extended. What do you make of that position from Israel?
I didn't hear his comments, so I don't know the full context. But what I would say to anybody who asked is there's two clear indications that this administration intends to revive a nuclear deal and lift sanctions on Tehran. Number one, certainly are these nuclear waivers that are an indication saying, hey, let's get back to the deal. We're keeping the door open to continue our legitimization of your nuclear program and resume all this international support to your nuclear program under the JCPOA. There's no other reason to do these waivers. But number two, and most importantly, there is an obvious mechanism to end the nuclear deal, right? And that is the snapback of UN sanctions. It's codified in the UN Security Council resolution. Iran's sunset provisions under the JCPOA, the expiration of international restrictions on Iran, continue to fall away unless you snap back the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 and restore the prior restrictions. We lost the arms embargo in 2020. This fall, this October, the international restriction on Iran's missile program falls away. Next year and then the following years, we start seeing the nuclear restrictions fall away. And so Iran is in, I mean, I don't even know what like extravagant word you could have for massive breach of its JCPOA commitments. But let's just say they've gone as far as you can without actually going to 90% weapons grade and building a bomb. And yet we were told if Iran breaks its commitments under the deal, our recourse is to snap back and restore all international sanctions and restrictions on Iran. Clearly, the decision is being taken not to snap back, to save the nuclear deal and preserve it for revival whenever the Supreme Leader finally says yes. Prove me wrong and snap back.
So one last thing I wanted to ask you about. The Biden administration has imposed various sanctions on Iran in recent weeks and months. It's imposed sanctions related to suppression of human rights with a violent crackdown on peaceful protests. It's imposed sanctions on entities involved in producing attack drones that Iran is giving to Russia. It's sanctioned entities involved in exporting petrochemicals and other energy products. Given your sanctions background and the work you did in the previous administration, what do you think of these various sanctions that have been introduced?
Listen, I want to commend the people who are very hardworking and committed at the Treasury Department, the State Department, who have been given direction to find as many targets as possible to hit with sanctions related to these illicit activities, whether it's the repression at home or the support to Russia for murdering Ukrainians in horrible war crimes. They're doing a lot of work. But I will tell you that they're doing it within a strategic framework that is broken, because they are still under a policy of preserving the Iran nuclear deal and signaling to Tehran that sanctions may yet be lifted and that the snapback of UN sanctions will not come. If you truly stand with the Iranian people, if you truly stand with the Ukrainian people, you would move forward on the snapback. You would have the President of the United States give a speech, which he has not done, to the Iranian people, announce that the nuclear deal is off the table, it is actually dead, not play games with this, not send secret messages. And that would lead to a lot more financial pressure on the regime. We need to actually start clubbing the head of the monster.
Well, Richard Goldberg, senior advisor at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, is speaking to us from Illinois. Thanks so much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran this week to share your perspective.
My pleasure.
On the issue of a snapback of UN sanctions on Iran, the Biden administration has said it believes the U.S. is not in a position to vote for such a move because in 2018, then-President Donald Trump quit the multilateral nuclear deal that authorized the snapback measure. That's it for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for being with us, and do join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.